Hello, I'm Dr. Scott Wattier.
And I'm Tommy Welling, and you're listening to the Fasting for Life podcast.
This podcast is about using fasting as a tool to regain your health, achieve ultimate wellness, and live the life you truly deserve.
Each episode is a short conversation on a single topic with immediate actionable steps. We cover everything from fat loss and health and wellness to the science of lifestyle design.
We started Fasting for Life because of how fasting has transformed our lives, and we hope to share the tools that we have learned along the way. Hey everyone, welcome to the Fasting for Life podcast. My name is Dr. Scott Wattier, and I'm here as always with my good friend and colleague, Tommy Welling. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
Doing fantastic, my friend. Today's conversation is going to be a good one. I'm going to put it out there into the universe. As always, we're going to have some fun, probably have some laughs, tell some bad jokes, but we're going to keep the main thing, which is talking about fasting and how to adopt this fasting lifestyle to get the long-term weight loss and health results that you have not been able to acquire up until this point. And that is exactly how you and I ended up here, Tommy. We both have similar stories and similar journeys. And if you want to hear more about that, you can feel free to go back and listen to the first few episodes of the podcast, learn a little bit more about who we are and what we do. If you are indeed new to the Fasting for Life podcast, there's a lot of fasting podcasts out there. It is a new thing, a new hot topic, a new conversational thing that you hear a lot more about.
Yeah.
Even though fasting's been around since the dawn of time. So we appreciate you guys listening. If you've been a longtime listener, give us a shout out. Let us know how your journey's going. info@thefastingforlife.com. If you're looking for some resources, you go to thefastingforlife.com. Go to resources. We've got a fast start guide, an insulin assessment, some tools to get you started or help you along your way on your fasting journey. And we like reviews. So now we are well over 1 million downloads. So just an appreciation shout out. We haven't done it in a while. We've gotten a little nerdy and some and diving into some of the more deeper physiological concepts around fasting and over the last few weeks. So I want to give each and every one of you listeners a shout out. Continue to tell Apple and Spotify and the podcast gods that we are doing something that is worth listening to. So drop us a 5-star review. Those are our favorite. Give us a reach out. Give us a shout out. Let us know how your fasting journey is going. All right, Tommy. So today's conversation, I'm just going to throw out a disclaimer at the beginning. Okay?
Okay.
You ready?
Ready.
Okay. So we are not going to be speaking around today's conversation in all seriousness from a clinical perspective. Okay?
Okay.
If you listen to this topic and you think that you align or have some of these issues from a clinical standpoint of an addiction, then we definitely want you to go get and get some help and seek out the right people. And we'll give you some guidelines on what that looks like. But we want to talk about an article that was written by Stephen Guinette. I'm not sure about the pronunciation. I did go in and Google the pronunciation ahead of time, but I didn't believe that that was correct because it seemed really jumbled. So he is a PhD and he wrote this article around food addiction and is it real and does it matter? So it's something that's out there and it's something that we hear a lot in feedback for people that are coming to fasting as a way to lose weight and regain their health. And there's a lot of conversation around cravings and off-limit foods or bad foods or sugar addiction, right?
Yeah.
And so we want to talk about this from a of an understanding that there is something going on with our relationship with food as a society that is leading to the skyrocketing weight and obesity epidemic that is then in turn leading to metabolic disorders, heart disease, diabetes, and all of those other comorbidities that come with, you know, blood pressure and cholesterol and thyroid and medications, right? So the reason why I felt like this was, we felt like this was a good conversation is there's a lot of correlations between our own personal journey and foods that we crave and dare I say, we're addicted to. So, you know, just overview, food addiction like drug addiction is not in the DSM, right? It's not in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. But what Yale has done, has come up with, because there is something going on again, right? With this epidemic of increased waist circumference and increased heart disease, and all of these numbers are skyrocketing, even though, not fear-mongering here, but even though we have more access to healthcare here in the States, we're spending 10 times as much in trillions of dollars a year on our healthcare system.
Yeah.
But we can't seem to get a handle on what's happening when it comes to our food supply and our manifestation of our behaviors. So it's really cool because we're going to speak through this from our own personal experience that there's a new tool that's come out, because a lot of this research is new, right?
Yeah.
And the new tool has come out from the Yale Food Addiction Scale, or the YFAS, and they've come up with 7 features of addiction that are incorporated into this scale. And when you and I read this, we both went, oh my God, I have those.
Right.
So can this really be real? And we're not going to go down the rabbit hole of rodent models and human models and how sugar has a definite dopamine effect on the brain. And I want to come from the palatability, the salt, sugar, fat conversation and that angle. And then really how fasting is like fixed a lot of this stuff for us. So anyway, that's the introduction. So here you go. I'm just going to sit back and listen for the next 10 or 15 minutes and have unpack it for us.
All right. So the Yale Food Addiction Scale, talk about mind blowing. Like I had never seen anything organized in this way. And honestly, if I had looked at this before my fasting journey had began, I don't exactly know what I would have thought. I probably honestly would have thought, well, that stuff doesn't really apply to me because I know how to track the calories and the macros of what I'm eating, even when I am eating the foods that I can't seem to get myself away from or can't stop thinking about. So to your point, salt, sugar, fat, that book really started to open my eyes to, you know, what could potentially be going on with my own psychological cravings, my own physiology, and the fact that what I was really craving or what I tended to expose myself to as far as ultra processed or indulgent foods for myself, because I grew up eating them and I had emotional ties to them. I really did highly crave them. Those were things that I couldn't separate myself from mentally. I could put them off. I could diet, exercise vigilantly, religiously even, and put them off for a while, but I would be craving them. I would be looking forward to them. I would even look for any excuse to jump off my diet bandwagon for the week by Thursday or Friday. Hopefully my wife was on board, like, hey, hon, you know, what are we eating for dinner tonight? Like, oh yeah, we already have that prepped, right? but you don't really want to eat what's in the fridge, right? Maybe we should just get a pizza. How does that sound? And then just kind of floating it out there. And if she grabbed onto it, it was like, yes, all right, cool. So I'm kind of off of this wagon, at least for the next couple of days. I can have some more of these highly craveable foods. That'll be okay through the weekend. And then I'll get back on board Monday. This was the cycle that I lived for years and years and years. And when I look at this Yale Food Addiction Scale, there are 7 points here. And I quickly counted 6 out of those 7 that I clearly had, despite probably not being able to admit it to myself just maybe 3 years ago. And it's eye-opening.
Yeah. So just real quick, the substance tends to be consumed in larger amounts or over longer periods of time than intended.
Right.
Reducing time. So these are already hitting home with me. Reducing time spent on important recreational, social, or work-related activities because of consumption. Persistent desire or unsuccessful attempts to stop or curb consumption. Continuing consumption despite negative physical or psychological consequences. And there's a little blood sugar meter there as an image.
Yeah.
Spending a lot of time on activities related to consumption or recovering from consumption. Needing more of the substance to achieve the desired effect. And withdrawal. So like unpleasant symptoms when withdrawing from the substance.
Yeah.
So again, when we started this, there's also another scale created, the Addiction-Like Eating Behavior Scale, the AEBS, and that's not directly derived from an analogy like, say, a drug addiction. difference with food is that we need food. We need inputs to nourish our bodies, right? So right. You don't need methamphetamine, right? Like that's sure. That there's a different level of chemistry that's going on there, but there are some similarities. And the most common one that we hear about is a sugar addiction, right? So, oh, I'm addicted to sugar, right? Well, I know for me, I've never been a sweets guy. Mm-hmm. So if sugar addiction was the main driver of the carb insulin model of obesity, then how did I get there?
Right.
Right. I fall more into the fat and also the savory type category, right?
Salty, so, crunchy, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's more me. And I'll sit there, you know, and this is what I used to do with the big bag of Skinny Pop or the bag of potato chips or that was me. Like I would always just sit there and we'll talk a little bit about those different scenarios and how we can combat them and give you some action steps. And, you know, fasting obviously is going to be the top of the list. And we're going to talk a little bit about fasting a little differently today in terms of your picking your fasting, choosing your fasting windows or choose your own adventure. But the thing with sugar, and it's the most common one, so I just want to mention it, is that, you know, looking at the consumption of sugar over the years, sugar consumption's actually gone down recently, but the obesity, overweight categories, and those statistics are continuing to go up, right? Mm. So is sugar a problem? Yes, it's everywhere. Yeah. And the USDA claims the average American consumes about 156 pounds a year, or 34 teaspoons of sugar a day more than what our body needs.
Mm.
So if sugar, so 6 teaspoons a day for women, 9 teaspoons a day for men is the recommended amount. But if sugar consumption has gone down dramatically recently, and we're more aware that big food exists and the salt, sugar, fat book, these genetically modified Twinkies that can, you know, survive for decades on the shelf, right?
Right.
Not real food. The problem is that, you know, when we're looking at the sugar consumption, that's where we get into the blood sugar swings, we get into insulin resistance, we get into a quick energy spike in the body, which then can cause that crash. It can also decrease, you know, BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factors. And that really can not allow our neurology, our neuroendocrine system to function properly.
Sure. Yeah.
Brain fog, post-lunch crashes, and all that. So that's the most common one. But what I love about the scale is that it kind of nailed me to the cross, right? Just like it did for you. You're like, wow, I had 6 out of 7 of those.
Yeah. And it was like, did I always have these? Like, did I just not realize that I had them? And I couldn't really like see the picture frame from inside the picture. It was like, I couldn't even understand that these were limiting not only my own results, but my own psychology until I started consistently applying fasting. Because once I started doing that, that gave a little bit of built-in separation for myself to where if I set a timer for 16 hours and I'm not going to eat anything for that 16 hours, well, guess what? That's 16 hours that I might have these cravings, but at the same time, assuming I stick to that 16-hour plan, I don't have the input. So I'm not going to stop by my local fast food place. I'm not going to order a pizza. I'm not going to expose myself to whatever that highly craveable food is for at least the next 16 hours. And now I have a little bit of time to think about it. So if I spend an hour of that time reading salt, sugar, fat, I learned something new about potentially one of the foods that was so craveable for me. I might have a little bit more mental ammunition to go, yeah, you know what? Maybe that particular habit's not really serving me super well. So maybe I'll limit my exposure even a little bit longer. Maybe when I break this fast, I'm not going to break it with that highly craveable food, even though I kind of like to. Maybe I'll separate myself a little bit further, which I think was like, I feel lucky that was built into my fast because I don't know if I would have gotten there like just on my own. Like I never had that thought that I needed to do that to separate myself, but it kind of just happened when I started fasting.
Yeah, it wasn't my intention either to end up in a place where I would have a realization that the thing that I was doing in the moment that I was enjoying for whatever reason, right, was going to result in me feeling a certain way, you know, immediately after the consumption, or let's say the next morning when my sleep was all disturbed. And I noticed for me, one of those things was alcohol, where my the realization came for me was actually with my kids, where it was like, man, I'm tired and I'm more angry and I'm more irritable the next day after consuming a few IPAs on a date night. I know we talk a lot about this because it's like one of those things that's just been a habit for that's been ingrained as a non-negotiable for so long.
Sure.
And in between, there's not much consumption, but that Saturday was not nearly as enjoyable, right? Like the weekends were starting off not feeling great and being on my game to be that better dad, that better husband. So that's where the realization has come in for me as well. Not just specifically like, you know, bantering back and forth about, you know, the research and medical communities don't really know if food addiction is a real thing, right? Like a substance addiction, like tobacco or a non-substance addiction, like gambling. There's really no consensus when it comes to food. But, you know, I know that on a Friday night, just like you would message your wife and be like, hey, so what do you want to do for dinner tonight? I'd be the same thing. Be like, hey, you want to go, you know, you want to go grab some drinks and hang out? Like that was my default because that's what I did for so many years through the being in the restaurant business and it just being like the social cue. And we'll talk about cues and kind of habits here in a minute. But it's interesting because when we continue to look at the things that like support the concept of food addiction, you know, modern processed foods that stimulate the brain, the dopamine response, especially the combination of fats and carbohydrates.
Yes.
Calorie dense processed foods, rich in refined carbohydrates, are more likely to trigger those addiction-like eating behaviors, while the more simple unprocessed foods are less likely to trigger. So there is evidence out there that people self-identify. This is why we're talking about it, because we hear this often.
All the time, right?
All the time. When you're addicted to a certain food and like you experience distress due to the struggles of trying to control that intake. And we don't, you can't restrict and omit your way to happiness.
Yeah.
And then the Yale food scale, you know, takes some of that criteria and applies it to the food. So it's not an exact like apples to apples, but there are some correlations there. And people with that self-labeled food addiction have a pattern of brain activity that's similar to the drug addiction or the gambling addiction. Now, when we're looking at like rodent studies versus human studies, like we don't want to go down that path. Again, not our area of expertise, but how can we then, like there are neurochemical changes that take place, but how can we insulate ourselves and encourage ourselves to celebrate the journey of how to take the situations, Tommy, that you and I experienced and actually put them into a plan, like where you know that you have the control panel in front of you where you can pull this lever down and bring this lever up to increase your confidence to know that, you know, maybe I'm not addicted to the food. Maybe it's the cue that causes me to exhibit the habit that manifests itself in a food-related behavior. And that was me.
Yeah.
That was me. The pizza, the beer, the Sunday fun day, the date night. Like I've had that realization recently where I'm like, the juice isn't worth the squeeze anymore for me.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't feel good enough. But if I was truly addicted to food, like how did I just meander my way through and figure out a way to break it? Well, no, there was some sustainable things that we did in between to get there.
Yeah. And I think you have to start becoming a little bit observant of those things. And sometimes journaling can help where you go like, okay, if I'm consistently setting a fasting timer, but I'm having trouble sticking to it, or I'm having trouble, like, you know, being focused on my why I'm actually doing this, or why is this important to me? Should I be consistently fasting? Because we ask questions all the time from people who follow us and who are on our email list and things like that. And the most common kind of response that we get for some of those questions is something like, I'm just having trouble getting back on track or consistently sticking to my timer. Well, I know for myself personally, especially when I started off with fasting, I had a lot of trouble sticking to it because of things like highly craveable foods that I couldn't wait to put back into my window whenever I broke my fast. So let alone the fact that I could easily undo my calorie deficit or, you know, any of the time that I had just spent burning through my fat stores, I could undo that by putting the wrong foods into that next window. But what I realized was I feel awful afterwards. I started to associate those negative physical feelings with my next fast. And each one of those made it a lot easier for the next time I set my fasting timer to go, yeah, you know what? I don't want to break my fast that way again, because that was not fun. I don't want to feel like that again. So that started to make it like a more natural process to where I wasn't just clawing my way to good habits. It felt like, yeah, I'm making different choices because that's how I want to feel. And that was much easier to do.
Interestingly, out of this article, right, that Dr. Steven had done this, like, if you look at I want to come back to that point. I have a point of going back just a second is if you look at the references, there's like 50 references in this article, like considering the definition, a critical exam of practical implications derived from food addiction concept, food rewarding cocaine increased extracellular dopamine in the nucleus, which foods may be addictive. So to your point of not just stumbling upon this, it was the consistent repeatability and sustainability of those fasts that, in my opinion, really balanced out my cravings and my blood sugar,
sure,
which can also lead to those things.
Yeah.
But one of the last takeaways I want to mention is that in here, there's specific research that hits on energy restriction and other weight loss diets, including those based on calorie restriction and carb restriction, directly reduced food cravings. So if you're sitting here going, wow, this is kind of overwhelming. Yes, this is me. I have a sugar. I'm addicted to this. I've got whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
Is that the first thing here would be to commit to, and this is what I was hearing with what you were saying, is committing to a window with a little bit of reflection.
Yeah.
Right? Like in the beginning, going all the way to back, the first time I broke a 24-hour fast or a one meal a day, it was not a meal. It was a buffet. And I told myself, I'm never going to break my fast that way again. Then I also know that if I'm going to be doing, let's say, a challenge, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to be doing an advanced schedule, a more aggressive fat loss schedule.
Yeah.
I am not going to eat high calorie dense, low nutrient dense foods before I go into waking up the next day and going into a longer fast, because I know my hunger cues, my blood sugar swings, my mood, my fatigue, all of that poor sleep is going to make me swing way into the, man, this is uncomfortable and kind of sucks category.
Right, right. And that is not a way to go into your next fast. That's not a way to enjoy the process. That's not a way to actually burn through those long-term fat stores consistently. That's not a way to gain momentum within the process. Like you have to set yourself up for success, and it looks very different from what you just described. It looks like intentional, a little bit of planning, and realizing when you feel bad with certain foods, and then doing something a little bit different intentionally and consistently.
Oh, I just love this idea. Well, we know that there's evidence that shows that fasting can help with that metabolic flexibility, better blood sugar control, insulin sensitivity, so you don't get those big swings or those big cravings anymore. Right. We also know it helps balance out your leptin and ghrelin, which is your satiety and hunger hormones, right? Like we know that those can then, once we pull the resistance down, you're going to get those hunger cues like that are really hunger and not just the cephalic phase and our five senses telling us that we are hungry because we saw the Chick-fil-A sign driving home. But I love this quote from Dr. Will Cole. And he talks about it's unique from, fasting is unique from other programs because it encourages people to customize their fasts, making it longer or shorter to suit their personal needs. So this isn't like a meal plan.
Yeah.
Like, here's your meal plan. Well, guess what? We're not a big fans of meal planning because we're telling you what to eat. Well, how about we teach you how to make the decisions on what works for you.
Yeah.
You know, that whole teach a man to fish analogy or whatever that I'm terrible at paraphrasing things. So I'm not going to, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So it's never meant, and we say this all the time, it's never meant to restrict or omit. It's never meant to feel punitive or painful is the wording that he uses, right? Mm. And if you have disordered eating, like, you know, let's get some help, right? Don't just try to do this on your own.
Yeah.
But the protocols for fasting are really secondary to someone's relationship with their body and their relationship with their food.
Yeah.
And that's something that we talk a lot about because it can be a trigger for some, but you can't hate and shame your way into loving the process. Like, we have to enjoy the process along the way on what it is that we're doing. And there's nothing better for me when I started to commit to it in the short term. Forget about the long-term goal, losing 50 pounds, right? I was just like,
that's a lot.
What is my next fasting window?
Yeah.
And seeing the wins, like, that was the accelerator for me. Right.
Yeah,
so I want to make sure we talk about a few things to curb this concept of food addiction, wherever you fall on the spectrum of in agreement or not. Right. But we didn't fast our way into obesity epidemic. Right.
Yeah.
We didn't yo-yo dieted our way and restricted our way into this imbalance that we're sitting in.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure that we talk about some actionable things that we can do to stop that. In my opinion, which is that emotional cue, which is where we talk about the HALT BS method and making sure, like you said, journaling, but we're identifying, like, what's my eating type? Like, where do I go awry? Do I overeat, you know, and eat to excess and then feel uncomfortable and go back for seconds, even though I shouldn't? This is the mental chatter component.
Yeah.
Am I a grazer? Do I just snack when I'm bored or sit in front of the TV and just open the bag and next thing I know, the bag's gone? Am I more like the professional, you know, I travel a lot for work, so I'll go and I'll have big lavish dinners and then drinks with the clients after?
Right.
Or do I overindulge at restaurants? Is it like I'm going to start with a drink, go to the bread, go to an appetizer, go to a salad, go to a dinner and take home a dessert?
Right.
or like, the, you know, the desktop diner. Now, today's world, we all work from home. Am I just, like you say, Tommy, the revolving pantry door? So you need to know where you are and what your kryptonite is and identify it first and foremost.
There's a lot there. You mentioned the HALT the BS method.
Right.
And I know a lot of folks.
Yeah, we need a framework because that was a lot of jargon. So yes, thank you.
It was great. The HALT the BS is basically looking at what are those reasons behind those triggers that might lead you to the behaviors that you'd rather not see, or you want to curb, or you want to get away from. Well, if you take a look and think about it like a checklist, like, am I hungry, angry, lonely, tired, bored, or stressed? Those are the most common reasons why we will go to food, especially those craveable ones or the ones that make us feel a little bit better, whether it's because it's a little endorphin rush or a little dopamine. Just it makes us, we have some happy hormones, some happy chemicals that kind of come out, or it reminds us of a happy time or something along those lines. It kind of, like they say, eating your feelings sometimes. I've done that thousands of times. So if you are feeling one of those ways when you find yourself reaching for that food that you don't want to be reaching for, or it's not serving your goals, then take a step back, count down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, even set a timer for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, walk away from the situation. When you come back, when the timer goes off, you're likely to have kind of rebalanced that emotional state and not feel like you need the food to kind of fill that in the moment. And then, you know, if you're in the middle of a fast right then you can just get right back to where you were and, you know, just keep crushing that fast right there.
Yeah. And I love, so the HALT's important, right? H-A-L-T, right? Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. But the B and the S are so much more important for me. Am I bored and am I stressed? So like identifying those cues again, I know we've said this a lot, but what time of day do you crave the food or what time of your fast is it? And typically for me, it was between 1 and 3 PM.
Okay.
And for a long time, it was post dinner. It was post closing my window when I was doing one meal a day with dinners.
Mm-hmm.
So what moods make me crave certain foods? In what situations do I typically overeat? With what people do I usually eat the wrong foods with?
That's a big one. Mic drop right there.
Yeah, right? So just
with
silence.
Which people do I typically overeat?
And what places usually end up causing those cravings, right? So is it the bakery at the grocery store? Is it the... So we need to identify where this the mental chatter begins. And then we want you to swap the routine. So we typically try to change the behavior when we need to change the routine.
Yeah.
Right? We restrict the behavior, but no, we need to try to insert something that, you know, let's say, you know, you have certain cravings at a certain time of day, or you're bored, right? Or you're mindlessly watching TV, or you're just hanging around the house, right? You need to like know that at this time every day, maybe it's time to go for a walk.
Right.
Or maybe it's time to put in that workout, or maybe it's time to do something for you, like something you enjoy to do. And I used to do this early on in the process, and I just forgot about this. When I would hit those points, if I stayed in the house because I work from home, this was after being in practice and out of the house all the time, where convenience was more the issue. But in the home, it was more of like the, well, I just milling around the house. I'm going to take a break from my calls. I guess I'm going to open the fridge, right? Like growing up, I can hear it in my head, like close the fridge, like from my dad.
Get out of
the
pantry.
Go outside. You're bored, right? Like, so my point of bringing that up was, you can't, if there's a, once you've identified the time, let's say, you can't just say, all right, I'm just going to sit by myself and stare at the fridge and expect my willpower. No, you need to put something in that space that you enjoy, like you mentioned, that changes that emotional state, which is then going to change the habit or the action.
Yeah.
It can't be like, oh, I'm going to go do something I don't like, because you're not going to keep doing that.
No, it needs to be the opposite of that. This is one of my favorite things to do. And I did a lot of this early in the process, was I started to make lists of the things that I really enjoy doing.
Oh, I forgot to mention it. I used to take the dogs to the park.
Yeah.
I loved taking the dogs to, thank you. I totally forgot, like land the plane. I used to take the dogs to the park and just throw the Frisbee outside in the cold, in the sun. And I would come back and be like, I wasn't even hungry.
Right. Right. But like put your favorite stuff in those toughest times of whatever fast it is. Doesn't matter how long or how short the fast is, but you should have this list of things that you can go to, because that's, you know, you talk about positive reinforcement. You talk about casting a vote in the right direction to undo years and years and years of these behaviors that we've like stacked on top of each other. We have reps and reps and reps that we're trying to undo here. Well, you're going to need some firepower for that. You're going to need to start putting those things in place intentionally, because, you know, one of the other things that we hear for folks who, you know, come into our group or come into a challenge is that when they're struggling with really highly like high food craving problems, where they're thinking about these foods a lot, it's making them, or they feel like they're breaking their fast prematurely because they're just thinking about these foods. A lot of times they're having these big swings because they're doing multi-day fasts that they think that's going to be the holy grail to like break these cycles. And so doing 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 day fasts, but then just coming back and almost like binge behavior sometimes, like I've been missing out on all of these foods I've been thinking about for the last several days. And then they like get off the rails. So it's these huge swings on the scale, in the psychology, in the reinforcement of the process. And then it feels like I can never really gain traction like this. So it's okay to focus on the shorter fast. Like getting the consistent wins is going to be so much better for healing the food cravings, getting momentum on the scale with your fasting results, versus trying to just like be a fasting hero, right?
Yeah. And it's what I'm hearing there is like almost putting in a couple of simple rules, like a couple of simple, like just basic frameworks where I know the triggers that I used to have, but now I don't have them anymore, but it didn't happen overnight. Fasting is simple.
Yeah.
Stop eating. But it's not always so easy. So like putting in a couple of frameworks that you can rely on, because it eventually they become habits, right? Like, let's just use, you know, for me, it's like, I don't eat chicken wings anymore.
Mm.
I just don't eat them.
Did you used to?
Oh yeah. All the time. Especially when back in the day.
Yeah.
Like football, restaurant business, restaurant manager, part owner. Mm-hmm. Like it was my go-to, right? So I can't just have one chicken wing.
Right.
And I'm not going to go and order six.
Yeah.
I'm going to order 25. So now when I do it, it is like super celebratory. Maybe the one or two times a year that I get to play golf, I'll go get wings. Mm. But then it's like, all right, I know it's coming. I'm planning for it. But it's like in the interim, if you're struggling with certain foods, then why not for the short term, take your willpower out of it and just be like, I don't eat French fries.
Mm, yeah.
Give yourself a break. You will surprise yourself when all of the wins that you get sticking to consistent fasting windows,
yeah,
and balancing your blood sugar and removing the insulin and leptin resistance over time, you'll be able to come back to that. Like I can now, I can go eat them and then I don't want them again for 6 months. Mm. But before I used to think about like
all the time,
going past my favorite wing place.
Yep.
I used to work back in the day at a college bar and it was 10-cent wing night. You better believe that, like, I look forward to that every single week. And I went home with containers full.
So, yeah, no wonder. I mean, that would be so hard to stop thinking about. I mean, like, think about how much thought went into that way back in the day. And even $5 worth would have been, you know, two or three meals worth of wings where you're thinking about it over multiple days. And then you had to drudge through the next 3 or 4 days before they had 10-cent wing night again, right?
Yeah, your willpower is going to run out in these situations, right?
Yeah.
Which it's just going to. So yeah, the last one I really want to unpack just a little bit, Tommy, as we mentioned, is the social networks. Mm. And there's studies that show that there's correlations between the groups that we so-called run in,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And the fact that obesity can happen in clusters, and there's a social connection to that. Like
sure,
the brother and sister study where, you know, if a brother tends to show, you know, abnormal eating patterns or obesity or whatever, then the sister or the younger siblings are going to as well. And I know for me, being a very social being back in the day, that, you know, it was part of the routine. It was like, hey, we're going to get together and go do this. But
yeah,
making sure that we're, you know, leveraging the external triggers from the people outside of you that have a potential control on your fasting window and your food choices.
Yeah.
So being able to say no or insulating yourself from those situations so you make the decision when you get to decide when you're going to consume, indulge, break a fast, et cetera. Mm. And it's just, we hear so much of the, oh, my husband said this, my wife wanted to do this, my family's coming in town, we had a pop-up, insert,
yeah,
you know, social gathering here. Some of those things can really become immediate yeses when they should be maybes.
Maybes or occasional yeses, or let me give it some thought and see if I want to participate, or maybe I'll participate in a little different way because, you know what, that fasting window for that time really is non-negotiable for me, but I do still want to partake in the social aspect of it. And that's okay too. And that can feel a little bit weird, especially early on in the process. But you know, that this reminds me of that saying, like you want to be a successful person, then, you know, go hang out with nine other successful people, right? And you'll most likely be the 10th. Well, the same thing goes for obese or healthy or unhealthy or insert whatever here. There's a good chance that you end up kind of as, you end up being highly influenced and somehow related in a lot of ways to your social network that you spend the most time with. So that's an important consideration. So drawing some healthy boundaries, especially early on in your fasting process. That's why we joke the first two rules of fasting, right? Don't talk about fasting. But at the same time, if you need to draw some healthy boundaries, because just like highly craveable foods, your outside network is tending to steer you in the wrong direction more of the time than you would like, then it's time to start saying no to some things, or saying, well, you know what, I'm doing this a little bit differently now.
Or you need to find a fasting buddy, because there's not, especially in the beginning, that's why the first two rules are the rules, right?
Yeah.
Until you get some wins and you see the weight loss and people ask you what you're doing, and then you tell them you're fasting, and then they revolt against the thought. Like, why would you do that? Right. So there's layers there that we are swimming upstream. We are doing something different. You know, there's a whole host of stumbling blocks in those conversations when you're new to it. But that study that I referenced, I want to be really clear on the numbers. It was from the New England Journal of Medicine, the spread of obesity in large social networks over 32 years. So it was 12,067 people. It was a large study, but 57% increase of becoming obese if you had a friend that became obese in the same given interval. So like with a 95% confidence interval, like siblings was 40% with a 95% CI. And then spouses was 37%. So the effects were not seen among neighbors, like in the immediate geographical locations and stuff.
Yeah.
But it was, there were phenomena that appeared to be relevant in the biological and behavioral trait of obesity. And it seems to spread through social ties, right?
Sure.
So
even
if it's not a conscious thing, you know, being around, like you said, you know, you hear this in mentorship programs for business all the time, right? Show me, you know, I'll show you your results if you show me the five people you spend the most time with, right?
Right.
And it's like, there's some truth to that. So we're not saying, you know, fire your husband or wife, cancel all of your friends.
Right.
But just be aware that there is a external trigger or control sometimes where these people don't, and not to say they don't, but they don't understand what you as an individual are going through, or what your health goals are, or what your why is, or why you even started fasting, or how many years you've actually struggled with weight. Or so many times do we hear like, yeah, this started for me when I was a teenager, especially in women or in girls. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we have similar things where it was like, for me, my nickname in gym class was Fat Face Wattier.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was literally it. That was I have a big head. I have to order hats specially online for a fitted hat. Like, I have a large dome. It's a 7 7/8. Like, it's big. Okay. So I can't just go and buy a hat, you know, first world problems off the rack.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And I have a court always growing up. Oh, look at his cheeks. They would grab my cheeks. Right. Mm-hmm. Even after I lost all the weight, I still have a big head and I still have cheeks.
Right.
Like, that is me. It's not going away, but
they're
a lot of this
anywhere.
Stuff. Right. Comes from so long ago. So these external situations, things that people say, they don't even realize like what you're doing or what you're trying to do. So I just encourage, if you're sitting here, we talk about this as like the marriage merge. If you're sitting here listening, well, how do I have these conversations? Well, here's my rule. Keep it to yourself until you're confident enough to be able to have that conversation.
Yeah.
If you're fasting and, how come you're not eating? You're 10 pounds into your 50 pound journey. Wait till you get to 30 pounds, because when you get to 30 pounds, people are going to ask you, wow, what are you doing? And you're going to have so much more confidence to be able to handle that situation because it is a real thing. It is that external cue or control from the social aspect. There's everything. There's a Easter, candy. Like, just look at the cycle of candy that goes through and the promotion that goes through our holiday calendar here in the United States.
Yeah.
We're taking down the decorations. We're putting up the next thing, taking this down. Okay. Now it's St. Patty's Day. Now it's 4th of July. Now it's a birthday. Now it's always something on the external that's trying to pull you off track.
Yep.
So really putting in finding a fasting buddy, going to the Fasting for Life community group, getting in the group, listening to the podcast, sharing the message with a friend, finding a fat, like those things can really help on this journey as well.
Yeah, they can. And I think getting plugged in is such a big thing, because you know, you really may be swimming upstream here, especially depending on who's in your network and you know, how familiar are they with fasting? Do they have the weight to lose that you have to lose? I just think it's a great point, because I was just remembering going through the grocery store recently, seeing these different like multicolored cakes, you know, like, so we're over here in Houston and it was like king cakes everywhere. And so those are for Mardi Gras, right? But just a few weeks back, it was like Valentine's cookies everywhere. And before that, it was New Year's this, and it was Christmas that, and it was pumpkin pie. And it was like, there's never not a theme of these highly, highly craveable, you know, high fat, high carb, you know, desserts. The things that if you're not careful, you can pack them on top of the food that you've already eaten, on top of the good nutrition that you already had. And those calories are just going to sit in there. That fuel is just going to sit there because it didn't make you feel any more satisfied. Now you're probably going to need to just set a timer and have some time to burn through those, because you're not going to be able to go have a piece of pumpkin pie and then go straight to the gym for 2.5 hours of rigorous exercise to kind of, quote unquote, you know, burn that off immediately. You're probably going to have to wait that one out. So think of all the times that you may have had that slice or whatever it may be. And think about that the next time you set your fasting timer. Give yourself a reason why I'm committing to this one. Just like if you're paying off $100 worth of debt, well, post it on your fridge and remind yourself why you're skipping your next thing to buy, so you can make an extra payment on that debt there. And think about it like that.
What I'm hearing is balance. Like, yeah, there's got to be a balance point somewhere in there where you can figure out how this is going to work for you. We want to be encouraging in this, yeah, that I didn't really know where the conversation was going to go. We knew where it started with our own personal journey, looking, sure, at the Yale food addiction meth scale and going, wow, that was me. Okay, well, what did I do over the last 2.5 years?
Yeah.
And what have we seen in our groups and the conversations we have and the questions we get? And yes, it's a fasting podcast. Yes, it's a fasting lifestyle, but we do need sustenance. And right, half of the problem, like I said, we didn't fast our way into having metabolic disorders and blood panels that were off.
I didn't.
We underslept, overstressed, yep, and overconsumed our way into these situations. So the best way to start is keep it simple. So I want you guys to, if you haven't grabbed the resource, go to the website, thefastingforlife.com. There's the Fast Start Guide, which now has 20 minutes of video support.
Yeah.
So you get access to 20 minutes of short little videos. They're 3 minutes, three, four, 5 minutes a piece.
Yeah.
And they walk you through exactly how to put fasting into your day-to-day life. And with that, I want to make sure just to highlight that fasting has been able to undo all of the stuff that we just talked about in this conversation.
Yes.
By simply staying consistent with fasting windows that fit you as an individual, mentally, physically, and emotionally, a fasting window that you can commit to,
yeah,
and stay consistent with. Forget about everything else we just talked about. Simply doing that and having you, Tommy, in our conversations, and this is why we started the podcast, is what ended up getting us to where we are now.
Yes.
And this is what we see in the continuity group, in the community group, in our membership, is that staying consistent, having an accountability piece, and just keeping it simple. Yes, we talk a lot about all the nuance and the psychology and the physiology, but keeping it simple, picking a window that you can mentally start to, is really the best place to start, Tommy. So as we wrap up today's conversation, you know, a delicate one, because there's stories on both sides. Is it clinically relevant? Is it not? Is it truly an addiction? Well, the reality is that we need to find our own way through this process.
Yeah.
And hopefully today's conversation is going to land with somebody. So appreciate the convo, sir. As always, send us a message, drop us a review, let us know how we're doing. Love and appreciate you guys for listening and being on this journey with us. Tommy, as always, thank you for the conversation, sir, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Bye.
So you've heard today's episode, and you may be wondering, where do I start? Head on over to thefastingforlife.com. and sign up for our newsletter, where you'll receive fasting tips and strategies to maximize results and fit fasting into your day-to-day life.
While you're there, download your free Fast Start Guide to get started today. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure to leave us a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Fasting for Life.